Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have a distinct perspective on time.
Welcome to episode 48 of Time Sensitive. This is the first of season 4. We're really excited to be back in the studio with guests and back to our regular scheduled programming.
Yeah, we've got a great season ahead, which is starting with a very auspicious guest, Myra Kallman.
The artist, author, illustrator, incredible all-around human being.
Just sort of iconic New Yorker, I would call her, who's of course not born in New York, but has been here many, many years. So one of the things that makes Myra such an extraordinarily interesting person to listen to and engage with is her approach to life. You know, she calls it the occupation of living and finds sort of the simultaneity in everything. Mm-hmm. You know, she talks about the COVID period and the lockdown as kind of miserable and hopeful. Everything with her contains the multiples and humor and sadness. And, you know, here's someone who starts every day by reading the obits, which, you know, I don't really understand.
I like obits.
I can't do that. But with her, it sort of brings her closer to life in a way. She's unafraid in all of her work and uses herself and the experience through the world as the lens or the filter for us to understand the world better. Mm. So we're sort of following Myra's view of the world through her work, which is incredible. And I love that she engages, like I was saying, in these mundane activities. Mm. Like, you know, she, for a period, not performed, I don't think it was like a proper piece of work, but worked in the commissary at the Met. And this isn't like a long time ago. Mm. You know, this is recently. Mm. She was a security guard. The other reason she's so appropriate for this show is because she's not one thing. You know, mm-hmm. she is a creative individual whose output comes out in all sorts of ways. She makes these extraordinary short films with her son, Alex. She writes children's books.
She did set design for David Byrne on Broadway.
Yeah, the set design and the illustrations on American Utopia, which is one of our favorite pieces. She also finds a lot of pleasure in cleaning and calmness in cleaning, which I do, so I really relate to that.
Yeah.
She's endlessly inspiring. One of those interviews that you leave and you kind of you see everything through her lens for a few days, thinking about her a lot. So I'm just excited to share it because I really, really enjoyed listening to her.
Mm. Well, before we get into it, though, I did want to mention just quickly, we have a new website.
Slowdown.tv. If you're familiar with our newsletter, it's organized around the senses, see, touch, taste, hear, smell. You'll find all of that on the website. And also you'll be able to link out to our multiple podcasts and platforms. Specifically, this show is at timesensitive.fm, which is a much more immersive experience than just listening to the audio. You have the whole interview condensed and edited in text, hyperlinked out, lots of images. If you're interested in the content and you want to check it out after the show or listen to it on the website, that's where you should do it.
Yeah. Or if you don't want to listen to us, you can just read it on the website.
Exactly. It's definitely the best experience for each episode.
Anyway, we got all that housekeeping out of the way. Now let's get to the episode. Here's Andrew and Myra.
Welcome, Myra. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
You describe your job as to walk around and look, and as someone who famously approaches walking as kind of like a creative act, what I kept thinking about was, how did you deal with 2020? Did you have to change your job description to like sit around and wait? What was walking like for you in lockdown?
There's always more stuff to look at than you can possibly imagine. There's no different. The world didn't know that there was lockdown. So there were seasons and animals and people and nothing. Nothing is an incredible thing to look at. And I just, Even more so, I understood how incredible it was to have that be an occupation that you just are able to observe.
Yeah. and look as an active act.
Always. But, you know, I don't mean that you try to look or that you try to be a different specific way. You just are. You're just there. And the work comes from that. I did as much work during 2020 as any other year, but maybe with a sense of a different kind of imperative or lack of pressure. But the work was produced based on that time, that amazing time.
So you didn't feel a sense of like being inside inhibited you in the way that you're so out in the world. I mean, you're constantly receiving in the world.
It was very interesting for me to think about, well, I can't travel. I've traveled so much. I can't travel. All right, I can't travel. Big deal. I can't go to museums, which are my lifeblood all the time. I thought, oh, I have a memory bank of museum visits that could last me at least through a year or two or three. And so I have this kind of adaptability that whatever constraint there is, okay, that's the constraint. And that's the unexplored place and time, found time and found more time.
Which relates to how you've described yourself, not as an artist, but someone who likes an assignment. You like guardrails. So this must have been comfortable for you. But I also imagine you doing a huge amount of kind of organizing, reorganizing, cleaning, more organizing. And I wanted to ask you specifically about cleaning and why you find a kind of joy in that.
Cleaning. I was cleaning the land as I was out of the city. And then I decided that I would cut the walk with a pair of scissors. And there was a certain absurdity to the amount of cleaning that I did outside. And straightening the land and straightening nature and trees. But I think that for me, and I know this so clearly, first of all, it's a way to procrastinate and to not do what you're supposed to do. And I have an aversion to doing what I'm supposed to do and wish not to. And then there is a sense of order and beauty that happens, and a sense of editing and understanding what's important. So much happens when you're cleaning besides the actual washing of the dishes. My brain just responds really beautifully to that kind of assignment and that kind of clarity. So I'm available if anybody needs me.
And you're constantly organizing things in your home, sort of straightening things or regrouping things. Does a certain comfort come from this curatorial effort of kind of putting things together?
So I have these rails in my apartment. I don't have anything on the wall, but you just put things on the rails, these narrow and shelves, and that keeps changing and moving and leaving. So the idea is that everything that I have is part of my work in the sense that it inspires me to do something.
Yeah.
I don't like things just lying there, not working. They have to be working also. But sometimes you wait 30 years for something to work.
Yeah. And you collect many odd things. What are some of the things you collect?
I don't know if collecting is the right word, but I acquire.
Right.
Moss. I have a big moss collection. And I've deaccessioned my egg slicer collection, and I've deaccessioned my international sponge collection because of the packaging. You know, that I'm endlessly amused and falling in love with packaging and signage and graphics, typography, and, you know, things that are written on menus. There's a Chinese menu that we just saw where it said something we don't know, as it were, the menu. You know, it was so beautiful and perfect. That encounter with language is always wonderful for me. So, yeah, I don't collect really important things.
Yeah, postcards of volcanoes, I read
once. Postcards of, that's true. Waterfalls, volcanoes, things that go up, things that go down. And then I paint them, or I don't paint them, or I think about them, or they make me feel better.
And you have this massive book collection, 5,000 books or something.
So you have to come over. You have to come over and help me dust them. Yeah, I have a massive library, which is a treasure of epic proportions.
And has that just been something you did with Tibor in your whole life, or books kind of something that you always valued and wanted to acquire?
Always valued. And we didn't have books when I was a child. We didn't buy books. We went to the library. So when Tibor and I started working at Barnes & Noble, which was the local college bookstore before Len Riggio bought Barnes & Noble, we just started to accumulate books and more books and more books. And every once in a while I say, that's it, I'm done, in some kind of ridiculous vetoing of buying more books. And then a minute later, I'm running to a bookstore and buying more books.
Yeah.
Which I'm never sorry about.
And making more books.
And making more books. I think in books.
Yeah.
I'm in a Shakespeare group. And the end of the year, we all read passages from our favorite play that we had read. And then we say goodbye to each other. And I thought, well, this isn't enough. These passages from these people should be a book. So I'm making a book. And somebody said to me, is everything a book for you? And I thought, kind of.
What is it? Does the book kind of complete the experience of learning? What is it about the process? Because it's not the end product, right? When you get the final book.
Well, when I get the final book, I kiss the final book. I kiss all my books. But the love of books and the love of the page and, you know, one of the things that I learned through this last year was that I clearly enjoy having a relationship with books more than most people, which is maybe not a great revelation to have, but it was kind of the thing that I realized that for me to be engaged with characters in a book or characters in a murder mystery, because that was also an obsession, especially at night, to watch as many murder mysteries as I could, I was living a different life, and I didn't have to engage, and I didn't have to say either smart things or stupid things. I had to just listen to them and maybe blurt out a comment once in a while, which I started writing down thinking that might be a book. But then I thought, these are horrible and stupid comments. But at any rate, the book for me is the answer to all questions.
It's interesting that you mentioned murder mysteries, because there is a sort of desire for the memento mori in your life. You said to Ira Glass once, I'm extremely happy and despondent in the exact same package. Just something that's really stuck with me. And, you know, I'm curious, in the context of COVID, did you continue the ritual of reading obituaries every morning?
Absolutely. You can't give up your obits, because they are activators of life for me. And the wonder of it, and the wonder of what people have done and how they've persevered and the courage that it takes. So, yeah, obits in the morning, murder mysteries at night, and in between, cutting the grass with scissors.
How are you processing, though, that sort of absolute devastation? Because it's not the normal obits every day. I mean, you were, for someone who draws some sort of process out of dealing and facing death, you know, very clearly, this period was just the ultimate expression of that. How did that affect you? How are you feeling about that?
I think that I was able to do what people do, which is to be devastated by what's going on and grateful not to have been immediately affected and wanting to do something to help other people, which is how Alex and I got started with our booklets of raising funds. And that there's no simple answer. It's all very complicated, both miserable and hopeful. Mm. You know, I'll always say the extremes, both stupid and, you know, that you do stupid things and smart things, and sometimes you don't know which is which.
The middle area is the problem.
I don't even know what the middle area is. I don't live in the middle.
Yeah. You made this extraordinary work that was presented on a billboard in Times Square during the pandemic called Love in the Time of Corona. Which is two people separated by this pink blob with rays coming out, which was the most unique depiction visually of the coronavirus that I had seen. It was different than the sort of angry red. There was love in it. How did this piece come about? How are you thinking about the virus itself at the time? Sort of multitudes.
Well, everybody was terrified, of course, and the lack of knowledge was large. Steve Heller asked me to do the piece. He asked a number of people to do the piece, and I at first said, "No, I need to not do anything right now. I can't handle it, and it's too much. It's too sad, and it's too much." And then, in the wonderful Steve Heller way, he said, no, I think you should. I'm not listening to your no. How about a yes? So I sat down and did this. And of course, I speak about wanting to not have relationships with people and to have the love of a literary relationship. But I realized, of course, as most people do some of the time, that it's really the love that makes, if you're not living in a life of some kind of love, then you really are saying, what's the point? So I thought that there was a kind of kindness. Kindness became a very important word, even though now it sounds like if I say kindness one more time, I'll, you know, go crazy. But that the feeling of compassion was essential. And especially after the Trumpian years of that kind of ire and anger and hatred, even from every side, if you don't think like me, I hate you. So that was a moment to say, how can you adjust that the best you can?
Right. And also, it contains something that I think is a through line in your work, which is a sort of humanistic point of view that contains this simultaneity. It's like the bittersweet. It is the sad but delighted, the love but the fear, all of it. Is that something you consciously think about, or is that just something that you think has always been there for you?
It's certainly always been there. The only question is how to handle it. That's it. It's not that it's going to not be there. Maybe what you learn as you get older is that, of course, it's going to be there. And, of course, you're going to be just heartbroken some of the time and dealing with tragedy that will descend and appear out of nowhere. You know, so you wake up in the morning, you don't know what's going to kick you in the head, and something certainly will. Even if it's a remark that somebody makes which it just crushes you, and you think, okay, that's it, I'm going to weep for the rest of the day. And then, of course, you don't. There's work to be done and walks to take and people to look at and the occupation of living, which is incredible. So I know as I get older that I will recover from the down, I hope.
Just before the pandemic, you were involved with David Byrne on American Utopia. You made this incredible book. Full disclosure, it was like the best show I'd ever seen.
You know it's coming back. Of course you know.
I heard it's coming back.
September 17th, to be exact, in case...
I will be seeing it several times again. It is an extraordinary piece.
Yeah.
I think his best work ever. And exactly what we needed at that time, which was, for me, contained in that really simple message in the opening piece, that our minds can change. They are fungible. And, you know, so I wanted to ask broadly how it was to work with him, collaborate on that project, be involved in something of need at that time, and how much you listened to that through the pandemic and what effect it had on you directly after it was out in the world.
We met, I think, in 1985, something like that, when Tibor was doing the Talking Heads graphics. And my fondness for him has grown and grown over the years, and my respect for him, because clearly he's maintained an incredible trajectory of work, and also his humanism, where he had more difficulties when he was younger expressing himself or expressing his happy self, if you're going to use such a stupid word. Now the joyous part of him is really present, and that's palpable in the work. It's palpable in the way that he looks at the world. In working with him, it's a joy. So we had a fabulous time, and everybody lets everybody do what they do. It's one of those, of course I trust you, now go ahead and do what you do. So his viewpoint, which is intelligent optimism, it's not clueless and it's not sappy or saccharine. It's really a sense of there's a lot of incredible stuff going on, along with all of the stuff that is unbearable. So we have a wonderful time. We're expanding the curtain now. It's moving to a different theater, to the St. James. The proscenium is a different size. So we're adding panels in a kind of visible mending way in the new world of making do with less. and not being being frivolous with how you spend money. Anyway, we're going to hand paint them, which is a wonderful way to
So the
hang
actual
from a scaffold.
Set change, it's not the chains anymore.
It's not the chain. The chains will be there. But the curtain drop is just going to, the size of it is going to change. That's all. And it's going to expand more imagery. So we're continuing to work together and working on American Utopia, the book. Again, it was the criteria that I have now for working with people is that I like them and that it's, it makes you feel good to work with them as opposed to why did I say yes? What happened here? And I have the luxury of being able to say no to situations that don't seem wonderful. So at any rate, we continue to work, and I can't wait to be there for opening night and see this phenomenal show. And he probably will write new text to address the pause that we've been in.
Did you listen to the music itself during
Always.
The
Always. Well, yeah, we listen to him all the time, and to that music, to the Talking Heads. And that, I mean, that was what my children were brought up on. So it's really part of our beings.
You've been taking walks with your friend Elizabeth for many years, for 20 years, three times a week or something, right? And aside from kind of having this great ritual with a friend to socialize, what do these regular walks do for you? What does this sort of routine of these regular walks provide you? And are you back to it? That's why I'm asking now. Or is this something that's come back?
We walked this morning in Central Park, and without question, it keeps me sane. Without these walks, I wouldn't be here. I would be in some place locked away. I think that my dependence on these walks is extreme, might be a little bit too much, but they provide me with a ritual that I adore. Once I do something once, it's already a ritual for me. So this 20 years plus, I think it's 23 years now, something like that. This ritual of consistency and how much things change within the consistency of the ritual, I can't imagine. I'm surprised when the entire city isn't walking in the park. I can't imagine what other people are doing. Like, what could you possibly be doing other than walking?
And you don't even live near the park. You travel to the park to take a walk.
Of course, yes. Early in the morning. We meet early in the morning. And we are never bored because everything changes from the light to the people that we run into. And even if over the years we've run into the same people, then it's kind of delightful to see, well, what are they wearing and what are they talking about? And do we say hello? The tiniest moments are the best, are the biggest moments. And that is another affirmation of there can't be anything better than just passing somebody and noticing their shoes or walking and noticing how a tree looks and then remembering a tree that I saw in Paris or in England and then going on to something else. And it's always about being in the moment, except for imagining other places. And it's always about not thinking, of course, which I've spoken about a lot, and maybe you've read that, but that's the most valuable part of it.
How did it get started, and why this particular person?
Elizabeth, Dr. Elizabeth Beautyman, I should say her entire name, because it's a beautiful name, and she's a beautiful person. When Tibor became ill, we were told we should go see her, and we did, and the minute I walked into the room, I said, this person is amazing. So not only as a doctor, but as a human. So we started walking together.
You met her through treating Tibor and remained friends. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And the Met, which we talked about for a moment, is a place you love in New York, also in the park. And you've done many things at. And I just wanted to go through a few of them to get at some of what they're about. One is my favorite, the museum workout.
Did you do it?
I didn't do it. I wasn't in New York at the time, but I really wanted to. This idea of engaging through time and space with your body in a place that you wouldn't normally do that. So in a way, there was this great generosity of like providing an opportunity. I want you to tell me about like, how did that project come about? It's such a wacky idea also. It's like...
Yeah, it became
so a describe it actually.
So the choreographer and dancer Monica Bill Barnes, she's a terrific choreographer and a great person, and she and I were trying to figure out how we could work together. We had wanted to do a project, and she knew how much I loved museums, and she knew about the walking, and the Met asked her to do something. So she came up with this idea that it would be a kind of exercise thing in the museum. And as we talked about it and worked on it and walked through the museum, the conversation was, you're walking through a museum. You have all these things to look at. You have to decide what to look at. How oppressed are you by those decisions? How inspired are you? How happy are you, or how bored are you? And so she created the workout where I would choose the path, and her associate Robbie carried the music on his, you know, like Bee Gees. And so this raucous, wonderfully high energy walk, fast walk exercise through the museum, stopping at different points where you heard me talking about different things about life and what art means to me, and how the guardian angels of the museum, because you're looking for some kind of truth. And then at the end, we were lying down. And then at the end, I said, well, we have to have something very tangible. So we had coffee and bread and butter and fruit. That I said that you need to, for me, everything ends with some kind of repast. Otherwise, I'll say, what happened here? And it was incredible that people were able to gather, go through the museum before it opened in the morning. So it was, you had the museum to yourself, and you were doing jumping jacks in front of a, you know, the Sargent painting, and with no obligation, no anything other than just, here we are doing this crazy thing that became so popular that they kept it going for a year.
Wow. And you've taken many jobs at the Met. You were a security guard.
Yes.
What is that about for you? Why have you sort of wanted to engage in so many different ways with this building?
Well, I do. The Central Park and the Met are really this glorious combination for me. And the Met, which I think is the greatest museum in the world, I also like to work in the places that I love. And I wanted to dust the statues. But they said, no, you cannot dust the statues. You don't have a degree in dusting statues. So, but a friend of mine who worked there, Chris Colson, said, but what else do you want to do? And we discussed things. And she said, okay, you can clean the floors and the bathrooms, and you can be a guard and wear the uniform, and you can work on the hotline of the cafeteria, the employee cafeteria. So I thought, this is fantastic. The same way that I love to read books and not talk to people, I prefer to have a job and not have to converse, which is, you know, I mean, it's funny because I'm conversing with you now and I don't seem to be having any trouble. I have trouble shutting up.
We're reflecting.
Yeah, I'm reflecting, right. I'm not conversing, I'm reflecting. But the sense of occupation and having a purpose, I kind of think I don't want to go to any more dinner parties in my entire life. All I want to do is, like, if you have a job for me to do at a dinner party, happy to. Washing the dishes, perhaps, or serving. I just like being occupied. It relaxes me in a tremendous, it gives my life meaning. Otherwise, I'm a little bit lost.
Yeah, the anxiety of sitting there like, do I have to say something? Is there an expectation of me?
And you always have to say something. So what are you saying?
Yeah.
No.
And it's New York.
So.
And so I before we move off the Met, the other thing, perhaps your most personal project, was Sarah Berman's closet. I think a lot of people drew different meaning from that, depending upon their own family histories, who they are, their own relationships with their mother. What was it about for you?
Well, Sarah Berman's closet was a recreation of my mother, Sarah Berman's closet. And it came about because she only wore white, and she had a pristine kind of Russian peasant style, starched and ironed, phenomenal linen and clothes closet, as did all the women in my family. So when she died and I stood in her closet, I said, this is going to be a museum. I don't know how or when or why. So we saved everything. And then 10 years later, my son has a museum on Cortland Alley called Museum in an elevator shaft. And then he had another little niche in this grubby, garbage-strewn alley, which I swept, by the way. That was my job. And we installed her closet there as a 24/7 vitrine, kind of something that you would stumble across as you're coming from a club at 3 in the morning. And a curator from the Met, Amelia Peck, came and said, this might be something really great for the Met. So we were, needless to say, deranged with pleasure that Sarah Berman's underwear was going to the Met. And it was juxtaposed with the closet of the richest woman in America in 1872. And my mother came 100 years later back to New York. So it was an understanding of what's important, what do you need, feminism, independence, because my mother left my father after 38 years of marriage. So there were so many questions of, like, how are we living this life? And it was through the context of a simple closet, a very, very humble, beautiful, all-white closet.
I think it's important to note what your son has done with that space, which is, you know, what they call object journalism. And from Objects Made in Prisons, which is my favorite project he did, to Sarah Berman's Closet, it seems like he must have gotten this reverence for object and the power of object from his parents. Was it a part of kind of your parenting? I know that's hard to answer, but was it a kind of part of your parenting where you would be, you know, sort of honoring something humble and simple for him?
It must have been the onion rings that we had on the wall. Clearly, that was the first. We had an onion ring collection that we had on the wall. The first one we collected was from 1968, and nothing happened to it. And we sold it to a curator from MoMA. But he says, and this is some conversation that we've had with other people, that that's what it was like. It wasn't as if it was taught. It just was. And there was a great joy in discovering things and playing with things. So that was the vocabulary at home. And we didn't know what would come of it.
We were talking to our friend Stefan Sagmeister the other day. We did an episode with him who worked for Tibor. And he had just gotten a new place in Miami that he was setting up, this new apartment. And he was stressing about the toilet paper collection that he was installing in the bathroom wall of 24 brands of toilet paper. On each individual peg, so you could kind of choose which brand to use at any time. And I thought, I don't know if that was specifically connected, but this idea must have come out of the work you guys were doing at the time of this sort of high-low, this reverence for objects and the power of their meaning when displayed properly, which I thought Sarah Berman's Closet was probably the most explicit, perfect version of. What was your mother like? How would you describe your mother?
Well, she was very beautiful and irreverent. She was an original and didn't have any expectations of us other than watching us live our lives. So she didn't tell us what to do. She never told us what to do. Except she did tell me when I should get Tibor and I should get married because we were living together for 14 years. And one day she said, I think you can get married. And so I said to Tibor, I think we're getting married. And so that's how that very romantic episode came about. But so we both listened to her because somebody who doesn't tell you what to do and says it once every 15 years, you pay attention. And I think I learned from her the fantastic value of not really caring what other people think of you. And I don't mean that in the disregarding pleasantries and being nice and kind as I went on about before, but just your ideas. Your ideas have to come from yourself and not from what other people might think or what you're supposed to do. So there's a wonderful map of the United States that she made, which was, for me, extraordinary.
What did she do?
And it was a revelation. Well, it was an egg-shaped thing, first of all, and that had California and Alaska right on the north, underneath Canada. I think Hawaii was on the East Coast. Because she came from Russia and from Israel, and she really didn't know. She threw in a few cities that she'd heard of. The North Dakota was below South Dakota. And various other quite mad things and a lot of blank spaces. And she said, sorry, the rest unknown, thank you. And I thought, that's all I need. I need somebody to say, just do what your brain does and don't worry about being right.
You also once said about her that stuck with me. You don't need to be an expert in something in order to find pleasure in it.
And you don't need to know anything in order to find pleasure. The less you know, the better, probably.
Yeah. You know, I often wonder, does this have anything to do with a kind of Israeli approach to life? Which, you know, I know very well. I've lived there. My wife's family was from there. And it's something that, especially in this day and age, I don't think people understand about a sort of spirit that Israelis have or had at that time specifically when she was there. I mean, you were born the year after the state. And it was a sort of DIY, live in the moment. You don't know what's going to happen. How much of Israel and the experience of being born there, living there for a little while, spending time there with your mother and your own life has informed your kind of worldview?
Well, I'm a very split person, but I want to say that my mother, who was quite quiet in her New York life, became a general, a military general when she landed in Israel and started giving orders to everybody in this fantastic way of self-confidence. And I think that one of the things, even though I can't say that every single person in Israel has this, but a tremendous life force and self-confidence, which sometimes people think is obnoxious. I've heard that mentioned here and there. But that sense of vitality and indestructible energy is something that's still true of the people that I know in Israel. And as complex and daunting as the politics is in Israel, the spirit of the people is really explosive in good ways.
Yeah, which is something that's sometimes eclipsed by the political conversation that happens outside of Israel. But all that aside, because that's not even something that I could imagine being productive and unpacking, I'd like to focus a bit on the spirit of it, which is something that I think's been missing in the conversation. So your memory as a child there, what's drawn you back there, why you keep an apartment there, all of that. What is it about Israel?
It's a big question. My family came from Belarus and escaped Belarus in the ways of the pogroms and the sense of persecution and danger, and they left before the Holocaust. Most of them did, except for my father's family that did not. And so it's inescapable that if you're in Israel, the sense of being a pioneer, even if we're in the modern world, the sense of triumphing over adversity, the phenomenal sense of humor, the voracious intelligence and curiosity. There's a bookstore every 5 feet, and then there's a cafe in between those bookstores. So you are just living life at a very intense, and I don't mean it's idyllic, and it's certainly not wonderful for many people. But there is a kind of irrepressible spirit that comes from what? From being persecuted for since the beginning of time, maybe. And having the beach. The beach gives you a nice lift. I don't know.
I mean, you're from Tel Aviv, which of course has the amazing Bauhaus community. There's also this sense of design. You know, we don't often think of Israeli kind of design as something that's kind of modern or kind of in the way New York looks at design. Right. But there's so much there. Do you think that you were seeing that as a child too and attracted to it?
We were definitely seeing it as children. We didn't know what we were looking at. But when we looked at a Bauhaus building with round windows, that impression stayed very vividly. And, it was like the world of Jacques Tati. But it was even more that because the sense of modernism, the sense of building a new city, a white city, where there would be equality for people and beauty, that was very intense. And just to walk around Tel Aviv now is so extraordinary. And the mixing of the Turkish and the Bauhaus and the British and the Brutalist is extraordinary. It is the biggest population of Bauhaus buildings in the world, as you probably know. So there's a tremendous amount to look at that's inspiring. And that modernism also informs the way people think.
Right. And it's about dialogue. I mean, in Israel, certainly in the way that Judaism is organized now, there's no really right answer, right? Everyone is not arguing, but in intense conversation.
No, you could say arguing. No, everybody, every conversation could be an argument. Everybody's got an opinion about everything. That's why it's good to escape to New York, where you can not hear the opinions for a while.
Yeah. And you originally thought you'd be a writer when you were a kid. What were you reading growing up?
Well, I've said my two favorite books were The Secret Garden and Pippi Longstocking. So then, as I got older, Nabokov became really important, and Salinger.
But ahead of the smart stuff, the Astrid Lindgren writing, what is it that really grabbed you about that character and that style of writing?
Well, Pippi was a child without parents. Hurrah. Number one. So all of a sudden you're thrust into this fantastic world where the children are making the decisions and they're strong and true and brave. And I thought, yeah, that's me. I want to be that. And I want to live in that world. So I don't know how I made the connection between her and writing, but I just felt that I was a writer. I think that sense of how you feel when you're 7 or 8 or 9, whatever those ages are, where you somehow, something lands in you. I don't know if it's even possible to explain it, because I don't know what the forces are that make you who you are.
But at a certain point, you decided, maybe I don't want to write.
Well, in college, after I was writing really wretched, heartbreaking, miserable, morbid, gloomy stuff. And I thought, choosing words is making me really sad. How about choosing some colors and some shapes?
And that's how you got to picking up a brush.
Yeah. And my sister was an artist, and I was looking at that, and I said, I've said this so often, that I said, this looks really easy. I'm going to do that.
Because easy is always better.
So it seemed like, why should I be suffering so when I could be doing something easy like painting?
And you met Tibor at college.
Yeah, we met at summer flunkout class. They said that if we didn't take these summer courses, we would be thrown out of school. As soon as I think about it, if that happened to my children, I'd be so completely freaked out. But I don't think my parents even knew, which is like the benign neglect part, genius of parenting. And so we met there. Immediately, we knew that we were meant for each other. Of course, we had to break up a bunch of times, too.
What year was this?
This was 68.
Wow. At NYU.
Yeah.
Amazing time.
Amazing time.
Describe what was happening.
Well, revolution was in the air in many ways, obviously social and political. And Tibor was very political and joined SDS and went to Cuba on the Venceremos Brigade. Big time revolutionary. I was a poet in the corner knitting him sweaters. And couldn't imagine how the revolutionary and the poet would ever get together. But we did. We persevered. He became less revolutionary. I became less of a poet. And we really started working together very early on and had a conversation that started then. And though, as I say, even though we broke up here and there because it was of the time and what one must do or one felt one had to do then.
For a sense of kind of agency or what,
yes.
What was
well,
the
breaking
up about?
I said, I can't stand you. I'm going to, see other people.
Right.
That was, I don't know if that's a sense of agency or not. It was just, I'm out of here.
Right.
So not too much kindness there, I'll tell you that much. But at any rate, then we would always come back together and then the rest became our lives.
I mean, you didn't want to achieve academically at the time. That wasn't clearly something you cared about.
No.
Were you thinking about the future? You talk to people so often about that time, and the future was something that you couldn't seem to depend on. So when you say working together, what were you working towards something? Were you working in the present? When you think about working, what was that about?
We didn't know what we were working towards. We knew that we wanted to do interesting work and that we loved working together. He fell into graphic design. I fell into illustrating. we saw that the worlds overlapped and that we could work together at M & Co, at the studio.
Which you'd both started.
He started it. I was there, but he started it, yes, with two other people. We never planned anything or thought about anything or thought about making money. We just kind of made do. And then things kept developing. So I took it for granted that everything always worked out, which may not be the case. It turned out not to be the case in some ways. But we were happy-go-lucky in many ways. And of course, he was brilliant, completely brilliant, and always interesting. I was never bored. And he was fearless and very strong, so he was able to get things done.
Right, and especially in a very kind of radical design firm. And it continued. I mean, you did Colors Magazine.
Right.
You know, I mean, these. When you look at what the work that M & Co did over time, and the fact that it's still important work, and it's still delightful, is so impressive. Obviously, you collaborate as an illustrator, but you were collaborating conceptually. I mean, your ideas were finding their way into things, but you were much more behind the scenes.
Right.
How did you feel about that at the time?
Fabulous.
You liked being
Who wouldn't like having ideas and then somebody having them? I don't have to deal with the nitty-gritty of getting them done. Getting them done is a big headache, I have to tell you. And it's very easy. I say it's very easy to have an idea, but go get it done. But we talked about ideas and my ideas and his ideas all the time. It was a constant life. And of course, my ideas seeped into the work, and both literally and also conceptually, as his did for me. So we couldn't have survived without each other. That's neither of us would have done anything close to what we accomplished without each other. That's clear to me, if anything is clear.
So fortunate. You said once, we could always be completely honest. I would not get hurt. Which, you know, if you're going to look
most of the time, right.
For advice on a relationship, especially a creative partnership, that's got to be it.
You have to be honest. If you're being polite, then that's nothing.
And then you had children. You had two children. How did that shift your priorities? Was there a major shift, or was it just in the continuum?
Having children for both of us was the most important thing that we'd ever done. And outshadowed everything. And the importance of their well-being and the fantastic life that we had with them was, first of all, I never expected it. You know, it's like you don't know what it's going to be like. But then when they're born, you go, aha, now I know why I'm here on this planet. To worry, apparently, 24/7. There was never any dissonance in the way that we saw our lives. It was very much about work, and it was very much about family, and that they didn't have to exclude each other, and you didn't have to be a miserable parent to be a successful artist or a successful designer or editor, that you could do it all and that it really does feed you. So that was how it was for us.
They were brought up in the studio.
Yeah. They caused havoc. They ran amok in the studio and at home. But no, I mean, there was a wonderful mixing of people and places. And it was really, we'll have to call them in here and ask them. But I think they had a good life.
And the way you tell stories in to children in your books is so matter of fact. You sort of make visible the good and the bad. You know, everything is sort of direct and honest. Were you that way as a parent? Were you very direct, or were there this sort of, am I doing this right? You know, it a similar approach?
This is the split personality part of being alive. Sometimes I think I'm spot on, and sometimes I think I'm clueless and have done a terrible job. So,
but you were always honest
tomorrow.
With them.
I was honest with them? Not at all.
Right. Well, that's what I was wondering.
No. I know. I was as honest as I could be under the circumstances. Because a lot of the time, being a parent is what you don't say. And really, to not make a comment and to let them just live it. And hoping for the best is, you know, that's what we say. because they know I'm around, but I'm going to let you make mistakes, be obnoxious, find your own way. That's very hard to do, but that's what we tried.
And when you got into making children's books, they were different. They didn't look, feel, read the same way the books at the time were. They were very different. Did you know that, or were you doing something authentic to yourself? And if it works, it works, whatever.
The motivator is to do something that I love. That's it. It's not about, let me try to do something different, or let me try to do something that appeals to this group or that group. It's, what do I need to do as an artist, as a writer, and as a painter? Which brings me back to my mother, or life with Tibor, that we just never thought about that. We only thought about what is the idea that makes you so happy that you want to work on it. So that was my approach to children's books. And also, there's a vast world of typography and imagery inspirations from Saul Steinberg to Ludwig Bemelmans. I mean, just like the people that were around us, we weren't in a vacuum. We're looking at a lot of work. When you see things that inspires you, you go, uh-huh, that's what I want to achieve in my work.
Mm-hmm. But Bemelmans and those characters were not like the thing when you were making the books. They were before.
I was looking at the work that I admired,
right,
through the decades of, right, design and literature.
Is Max based on you?
Yes.
In which ways?
A hapless, heartfelt poet waiting for funny things to happen, which they always do.
Were you aware that it was based on you, or were you?
Oh, yeah.
Did you think you were writing a character?
Oh, no. No, I can't write characters. Everything I write is about myself. Whether it's a dog or not, yeah. The people that are in the books, or people that I knew, Bruno painted invisible paintings. Bruno Jakob is a wonderful artist who paints invisible paintings. And yet I can say he's a wonderful artist. So once again, it was all about my life.
Because, and that old adage, the personal becomes the most universal. Couldn't be more true.
You hope, yeah.
Yeah. You know, another project that comes to mind is Unfashion, which you did with Tibor. So what was the intention of the book, and what was the experience of making it? I often fantasize that it was like, well, it was like an excuse to go see things. How much of it was an excuse to have the process of doing it, and how much was about the output?
Well, it's all a mix, the curiosity about places and people. We didn't take all those photos. Unfashion was, again, celebration of the way people dress all around the world for ritual, for daily life, for sport, for war. And we just love all of that. The fashion of humanity is a big subject for us. It was Tibor's idea, let's do Unfashion. And I thought, what a great idea. That's all that it took. And then we just started collecting imagery, working with researchers. Actually, Kevin Kwan, who wrote Crazy Rich Asians, was the researcher for us, because he was a photographer at the time and a writer and just this all-around really wonderful, smart guy. And so I was working with him. And then in the middle, Tibor died in the middle of this, of working on this. And so Kevin and I continued together. And it was a very sweet time to work with him.
Mm. When Tibor passed, you were confronted with sort of, what do I do professionally, right? You know, do I carry on M&Co? Like, what?
Oh, I had no doubts in my mind. I was not going to carry on M&Co. You know, the decisions that you make in a split second without any thinking or without anything, you're just going with your gut instinct. And Tibor had said to me, you have to promise to continue M&Co. And so I did. And then I thought, well, that's a promise broken. Because I didn't want to be bound by what he had done. I wanted to do what I was doing. And it didn't mean that I was now saying, aha, now I'm out of the shadows. It wasn't like that at all. It was an evolution of a person. And the work that we did together and the life that we created was incomparable. And now I said, okay, now what? So even though M&Co products continues and I was creating products for MoMA and for the product line, I didn't feel I needed to continue a graphic design company and have clients. No. And I didn't for a minute hesitate about that.
He was 49. I mean, yes. Incredibly young. Mm. Did you still have kids in the house?
Yeah. The kids were 13 and 17 when he died. So there was the desire to comfort and take care of them and to take care of myself.
Yeah.
I know that people probably talk about this, but somehow I always said that I ingested his courage when he died, that I wasn't left bereft and hopeless. I was left with a great desire to live and to fulfill my sense of being a person and working. So that's what happened.
And you became incredibly productive. Like, you moved into the most productive period of your life, probably. And this sort of forward motion and momentum that happened, did it take a while or did you dive right in? You know, did the productivity ramp up? How did this occur at like a very low moment, you would imagine?
I dove in head first. There was the T. Borosity show, which had to be designed, a retrospective of his work. It was a huge show that was traveling, and other projects. So I had work to do that had to be attended to, and I just never stopped.
And the work must have kept you away from the sort of sadness of doing nothing and thinking.
Work is a great solace, and the engagement with work is a great antidote to sorrow.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about back to walking before we move on too much. But the rhythm of walking, moving through time, your books are kind of drawings through time as you experience them. How much do you think about the rhythms of books and the rhythms in your life? Are you conscious of the kind of tempo that the narratives you create make, and you draw that from the tempos you see in life? Or do they just occur differently in the books? Why do they feel so much like life, the divergent mind?
Because it's messy and unpredictable. And the books follow my messy and unpredictable life. I have book obligations for the next few years, but then things shift and something moves around. And then I say, oh, but I'm really interested in this and not in that. And I'm working on a multi-volume compendium of knowledge, or the lack thereof, that's the title. And I think, oh, well, maybe that's what will happen. And then something appears or somebody calls and says, do you want to do this thing? So there's room for exploring, and there's room for messiness, and there's room for not knowing.
Right. And you and your son collaborate on these incredibly beautiful short films that are sort of connected to the books. And I wanted to take a second to talk about one of these. First of all, how rare it is to see that collaboration, you know, to see a family collaborate in all these different ways, and how beautiful that is. I'm sure you see that. But what do you love most about working together? What do you think you can do with him you can't do with others?
It's really so extraordinary. I have to say that I'm fortunate beyond. I mean, both my children are amazing, but to be able to work and have the kind of dialogue where the aesthetics, it's really shorthand. We understand what we're trying to get to. We understand the kind of emotional component of things. He's very kind, and he's also a humanist and believes in the eccentricity of the human voice. So we haven't had any big fights yet. Wait, the night is young. And so it's extraordinary to be able to create work together that's beautiful and smart and funny. He has, you know, he has a great sense of humor, which we have to say was a big part of Tibor's and my way of looking at work. And so it's fun. It's just tremendous, beautiful fun. And we understand each other, what we're trying to achieve.
the one where you go out and interview dogs, you have this one moment where you say, you know, what do you think is better, thinking or feeling? I can't decide. Are they the same thing? And I just wanted you to answer that question. Do you have an answer?
Does anybody have an answer?
It's a hard one.
Well, first of all, you're going to have to accept the fact that it's a thinking and feeling kind of roller coaster that your life is. But we always say, don't think too much. That's a given. But my favorite is when I have to say the Alice B. Toklas with me with a prosthetic nose and a little mustache and her wig, because I just feel like I completely inhabit Alice and her persona. And I just loved her relationship. And of course, I've spoken about how her relationship with Gertrude Stein mirrors, in a way, my relationship with Tibor. Because to say somebody's in the background is maybe the obvious statement, but it has nothing to do with the real dynamic of what's going on between a couple and between the importance of the voice of each person. So I kind of embrace them as I embrace Tibor and Myra.
Yeah, and it comes through in that specific film that you make because, you know, I answered the door and made people go away. You know, I made the food and she needed the food. This sort of the balance required in two characters that are extremely high performing in different areas.
But I want to say that it's not she did answer the door and she did make the food and she did embroider and type all of the manuscripts. But for me, reading their books, reading her books and her cookbooks and Gertrude's books, Gertrude is channeling her voice completely. So it's not as if Alice didn't have an interesting voice. By voice, I mean expression of the way she looked at things. It was a gift to Gertrude to be able to use that. Anyway, so I hope I have a bigger career as Alice B. Toklas.
Yeah, she's just known for the weed cookies. Now,
right.
You ask
exactly.
Most people, like,
right. Of
Alice
course.
B. Toklas.
If they know, even if they know that, the hash brownies.
Right. And you placed it in New York, so you're getting like a hot dog and doing these like simple joys of New York as Alice B. Toklas.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Very intimate. You know, looking and responding is so much, obviously. I mean, I know it's very simple, but, you know, you've had these incredible assignments of going someplace as a kind of journalist almost to process an experience. Corbusier's home, the White House. What are these assignments like? And how do you seem to get at something that's so unexpected every time? The thing that is eye to eye, the human scale of it.
I just follow what's interesting to me. I don't care about the assignment so much in that I don't think I have to fulfill some kind of obligation of what you might expect. I don't know what you expect, so it doesn't matter anyway. What I have to tell you is the story that happens to me as I see it. So that's why I love, as we said in the beginning, I love an assignment because I love the relationship to the real world, and I have a project that I have to respond to as a writer and as an artist. But after that, then all hell can break loose in a beautiful, creative way.
So you get a call to go to the White House, and you're like, great, I'll go to the White House. This seems fun. And you have no maybe I'll cover that. You just go.
Right.
So it's important to you in this idea of not thinking also to just show up and respond. What was it about Corbusier's sink?
Well, I have a special love of sinks. If I could collect sinks, they would be lined up in my room. It's not that his is my favorite sink. Let me make that clear. But the Corbusier sink, you know, when you come upon an object, an inanimate object that speaks to you very loudly, you have to listen, you have to pay attention and not ignore it. So I walked into the room and I just looked at that sink and I thought, whoa, that's a beautiful proportion, a beautiful color, beautiful light coming through the window nearby. And the architecture of a room is probably the most important thing that affects you during the day. and maybe in your life, you know, that you're just subject to these incredible structures that you're walking through. And so I respond very much to the utilitarian rooms. I mean, I love grand rooms, and I've photographed and painted many, many great rooms in many palaces, and wouldn't mind going again. But the utilitarian rooms appeal to me because I know I would be happy working there. I choose a sink that I would be happy washing the dishes.
New York City, and it's something I spoke to your good friend Roseanne about, has played such a major role in your life and how you see things, the city itself. You are a New Yorker. What was it like to do that cover, New Yorkistan, for the New Yorker at that time, which seems to me to be very much reflective of this moment where humor and comedy is in crisis?
Right. Now it's best not to say a word about anything. Don't say anything about anything. Well, the New Yorkistan cover was done in collaboration with Rick Meyerowitz. And he was also a cartoonist, a writer for the National Lampoon.
He did the Animal House
yes,
poster.
Animal House. So he had a long history of irreverence and sarcasm and satire. A long history of being nasty. No, but so when we worked on things together, there was also a natural dialogue of love of play of words and language, love of the subject, both love New York, and a kind of awe at what was unraveling or developing before us. So we just started talking about this tribal city, and that grew into the map, which the New Yorker thankfully put on the cover. And we probably insulted a lot of different people. And I don't even know if we can make that map now.
Yeah, you wonder, could that be?
I don't know. We'd have to go through it. I don't remember most of the names, but, you know, except for Fat Tushies. And you say, well, you can't say that. I didn't say that.
Do you worry now in this time of cancel culture, whatever we could call it, that humor, you know, is in crisis? Do you see yourself holding back now in certain ways?
I don't even know what to call it anymore, but there definitely is a second guessing of everything that you say that might be thought of askance. However, there's also something good about rethinking how you think about things, and there's also something good about changing, and that it's inevitable that language changes and your perceptions of what's cruel changes also. That's not a bad thing. That's a very good thing to reassess. And if you have constraints that make you stop for a minute, fine, then you stop for a minute. It doesn't take away the sense of whimsy or wit or humor that lives through the day of your life anyway. It's not as if humor has to be mean or even controversial. So I think that I'm perfectly happy to consider how language is changing with some annoyances sometimes and say, oh, really? And that, but things will change. And then people will find their way to be funny.
We can hope.
We must hope.
Before I let you go, the final question. I read a quote once where you said, not trying to be anything other than who you are, that's an absurdly difficult thing to do. And it takes many years. I know it's a tough answer, but from your own experience, what got you there, or what is getting you there?
If I had to give you the short answer, it would be that I felt I was loved as a child. And that sense of being loved is so extraordinarily strong that I think it carries you through tragedy and torment and all of the other things that happen to a person. whatever persona you're born with, whatever things that make up your being, that I don't know. That's impossible to know, obviously. But I do think that it's the obligation of the adults around children to make them feel incredibly loved. And if you've done that, you've done the most important thing you could possibly do.
Well, I'm there. Thank you, Myra.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Listen to our other podcast, At a Distance, by heading to atadistancepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Tiffany Zhao, Mike Lala, and Pat McCusker.